This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Greeley, Colorado. It's a place to watch your step. In this town, about an hour's drive north of Denver, ice patches are everywhere. The last thing I want is to slip and break a bone. Something that's never happened to me, thank goodness, but which I've seen on TV. Millions of us did back in 2013 when University of Louisville basketball player Kevin Ware suffered a gruesome injury during a game.
Kevin Ware just took a shot. Oh my goodness. That is a gruesome looking injury to Kevin Ware.
Look at his teammates' reaction to it.
He's dislocated some portion of his leg there, Jim.
Part of Ware's calf bone, his fibula, popped out of his skin. He has since recovered, and he's playing pro basketball overseas now. But the video of the injury is extremely hard to watch. And yet, people watched it over and over. There's something about our bones that fascinates us and has throughout our history. What makes our skeletons so unique? And what do they teach us about our species and ourselves? Joining us from KUER Public Radio in Salt Lake City is Brian Switek, the author of Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bone. He also writes about fossils for Scientific American on the blog Laylaps. Brian, welcome to 1A.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
You know, we just heard that moment that went viral, where millions of people were kind of horrified and captivated by the sight of that bone, the fibula popping out. Clearly, there's something about human bones that it fascinates us, especially in the movies. There's this new movie, Glass, that just came out where Samuel L. Jackson reprised his role from the film Unbreakable. Here's a clip from Unbreakable in which the villain, Mr. Glass, suffers from osteogenesis imperfecta, which makes his bones very fragile. Listen.
I've never seen this. It appears that your baby has sustained some fractures while inside your uterus. His arms and his legs are broken.
A clip from some of the villain's backstory in the movie Unbreakable. Why do you think there is this cultural fascination around bones, Brian?
You know, it's somewhat hard to say because it has to do with the poetry of bone, the way that it looks. It's this evolutionary architecture that not only lives inside us, but, you know, all vertebrates, all sorts of animals from, you know, frogs that are the size of a fly to, you know, dinosaurs that grew to be over, you know, 100 feet long. And I think bone makes us ask questions. You know, why do we have it? What does it do? What is it anchored to? How does it allow us to move and grow? And there's something, you know, aesthetically wonderful about it, but I think it really draws some of our persistent questions about natural history and who we are and how we got here out, and the permanence of bone as well. The fact that, you know, it's one of the few things of ourselves that can last for millions and millions of years after we pass away and tell our stories. I think that's certainly part of the draw as well.
Are there any particular breakthroughs that are top of mind for you in terms of what human bones have taught us about human beings?
You know, I think a lot of it has to do with our history and where we came from, that, you know, we are not an exception that just popped into being, that we have a long and interconnected evolutionary history, that we can look at our own bones and the skeletons of other species and see some of the same bones. This is a concept called homology, where because of common ancestry, I can look at, you know, my dog Jet, when I'm home, he's a German Shepherd, and know that in his skull he has some of the same, like, you know, his frontal bones, just like I have frontal bones. He has femoral or thigh bones, just like I do. And this connects us to each other. In terms of understanding ourselves more specifically, just what's possible in terms of our culture and what we've created is sort of allowed and defined by our bones. So, for example, the fact that we have a base 10 counting system in, you know, many cultures relies on the fact that we have 10 fingers, and that's an evolutionary accident. Or the fact that, you know, something like baseball, the fact that someone can throw a fastball or throw overhand is allowed by the fact that because of our ancestors, you know, 5 million years ago, who lived in the trees and were moving in a very different way from us, got this flexibility that we inherited that opened up the world into certain ways and certain activities that wouldn't have been possible otherwise. So that our skeletons, you know, limit us in some ways, but they've also made so much of our culture possible.
With regards to the cultural place that bones hold, Jose tweeted us a question.
We'll get to that after you hear this.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. Business owners can count on LegalZoom for legal advice and no surprises. Over 2 million business owners have trusted LegalZoom for LLCs, S-Corps, and DBAs. They've built a network of independent attorneys available in all 50 states, and LegalZoom provides complete transparency with upfront pricing and customer reviews to bring you peace of mind. More information is available at LegalZoom.com/NPR.
This season on Invisibilia, should we empathize with our enemies?
Femoids should f***ing die.
Is it okay to have machines control our emotions?
I should be kind of creeped out, but at the same time, I'm like, well, thank God I live in this day and age.
No easy answers, just the right questions. Invisibilia, back on March 8th.
Back now to our conversation with Brian Switek. Jose tweeted us a question in Spanglish, and I'll do my best. Jose tweeted, Día de los Muertos is full of skeletal imagery. Es un modo de respeto, it's a form of respect, and acceptance of death. ¿Qué son los American equivalents of this tradition? What are the American equivalents of this tradition? Is there anything in American culture that compares, Brian, with other cultural recognitions, cultural ceremonies like Día de los Muertos in Mexico or others?
You know, I haven't yet come across anything quite like that in our American culture so far. And in fact, I called out Día de los Muertos in the book as a great example, as a positive association of bone, because I feel like in, you know, mainstream American culture, we usually only see bones, at least in their cultural representations, when something has gone wrong or has as a symbol of the afterlife. So you see it on, you know, the Jolly Roger pirate flag or, you know, poison labels or death metal album covers and stuff. You know, I've got quite a few, you know, t-shirts in that mode myself. And we usually think of it as representing death, something that's you know, afterlife, something that's static, something that's very final. And what I like about Día de los Muertos and other expressions is that it gets at the vitality of bones, that bones are alive and they're, you know, very much connected to us. And I'd love to see more of that cultural shift occur in our society.
Speaking of cultural observances, it can't be overstated how important that bones and burial sites are to indigenous peoples here in the United States and elsewhere. And last week, the FBI revealed that in 2014, it uncovered this huge collection of human bones and other artifacts in the basement of a rural farmhouse in Indiana. This is FBI agent Tim Carpenter talking about the raid to CBC Radio in Canada.
We were not prepared for the amount of human remains that we discovered on the property. I suspect they'll be working on this case after I'm retired.
That's FBI agent Tim Carpenter speaking to the CBC. Now, the collection contained 500 sets of mostly Native American human bones that were likely looted from burial grounds. Not 500 bones, 500 sets of bones. And the FBI made the raid public because it says it needs help figuring out where the remains came from. Brian, how common is this kind of looting, of stealing human skeletons?
It's incredibly common. It's really tragically common. It's something that I'm sure, you know, even some listeners right now might, you know, you know, a relative or something that's been passed down in their family, like, you know, a literal skeleton in the closet or in the attic. And, you know, it's something that has extended this looting mentality that existed from the early days of anthropology and the science of studying people through the late 19th century, where it started out as, you know, really just trying to build museum collections, trying to push people into certain racial categories and rank them, and, you know, this misguided aspect of that science, but then continued from there, where it was this kind of paternalistic and colonialistic view that, you know, indigenous cultures need to be preserved. So this is the, you know, if they might go extinct, we need to have these bodies and these artifacts. And of course, that's terrible. And that's not true. It's since been reversed, but did incredible damage to these communities who were already oppressed. And, you know, this continues. This is not, you know, even though the collection that this one particular person had was, you know, exceptional in its extent, the number of people who probably have human remains, you know, that have been passed down in their family and no one knows where they came from is probably quite common.
With regards to the history behind bone collection, there was an anthropologist named Samuel Morton back in the 1800s who collected around 900 human skulls. Tell us a little bit more about Samuel Morton.
So Morton has often been held in anthropology textbooks and sort of lore as like the objectivist of his time. So he came out with a series of books where he was trying to basically look at endocranial capacity, the capacity inside the skull that would have held the brain, because it's a relatively tight fit between brain and skull, and figure out the races of people. He thought there are five races of people, and make those divisions on the basis of skull volume. And he's often been using examples like he just took the measurements, he didn't theorize, he didn't hypothesize, he didn't say anything else about it. He just, here's the data, and that's it. But what we know about science and how it works is that there's fact and there's theory. And the way that you interpret facts or what you observe depends very much on your cultural background and what you think and how you were trained. And, you know, it's a case of basically garbage in, garbage out. So even though Morton didn't extend from his data to say, okay, people should be ranked in a certain way, he had no problem with other people doing this during the 19th century. And that's basically the upshot of what his research became. And it turns out, as you know, the essayist and paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould pointed out in a book called The Mismeasure of Man, that in Morton's experiments, he did some with mustard seed first, and he found out that was too malleable. He was getting different results, and he switched to lead shot eventually. When he compared these two measuring techniques, Morton was, you know, perhaps unintentionally, but one way or the other, suppressing the volumes, basically the brain sizes of what he thought of as lower ranking races. Right. Now we know that, you know, race is a social and societal construct, that there's no biological backing for any of this.
Right.
But this was highly influential at the time. These books were not just scientific arcana. These were popular and used to support some really reprehensible social programs. People who supported slavery often cited Morton's work. It was a really, you know, terrible episode in the history of anthropology.
Peter commented on our website, the1a.org, can the guest comment on the relationship between the global trade in human remains and war? I studied in a department of anatomy in the 80s. Once, I entered the office of a faculty member while he was unpacking a skeleton, examining the skull. The one he was unpacking, he believed to be a young male of East Asian descent in his 20s with perfect teeth, most likely from Indochina, a result of the wars and their aftermath there. I sadly fear human bones entering today's market may hail from the mass graves of the Middle East. Brian?
Yeah, I don't have as much experience with specific cases like that, but there has been a long tradition of human remains and skeletons being taken from these tragedies and these conflicts, you know, even back into the heyday of the pseudoscience called phrenology, which was basically a forerunner to what Morton was trying to do, where, you know, conflicts, for example, in South Africa with the Xhosa people, that the dead from those conflicts, the skulls would be taken and then measured, you know, sort of the shape of the outside of the skull was believed to show certain, you know, aspects of intelligence or behavior, and then used to further oppress those people who are already being oppressed by the colonizers. So there's been a long history of this, and there is quite a persistent, what journalist Scott Carney has called the red market, you know, trade in human body parts, including bones throughout the world. And it, you know, it's as close as your smartphone, that you can go on Instagram, and if you know the right tags to look at or to follow, you can 1, 2, 3, you know, buy a human skull or finger bones or whatever it is, because the trade, with some exceptions involving, you know, Native American remains, involving remains of forensic interest, is largely legal. It may not be ethical. I certainly don't think that it is. But based upon, you know, where you are in your state laws, it may be perfectly easy to buy a human skeleton of unknown origin.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Instagram. I was just going to ask you about the role of the web and social media, but as it relates to Native American remains, and we will talk more generally about bones in just a bit, but there are some laws that govern the treatment of tribal remains. Particularly, I wanted to ask you about the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. What does that do?
Right. So this was an effort. It got enacted in, I believe, 1990, and there's a recent update in 2010. And it was a way to try and make some progress against what we were just talking about, this culture of looting and collection that existed for so long, and repatriating remains of Native Americans and indigenous peoples back to the cultures and the lands from which they came. And this has been an ongoing process. And it's one of these laws that it wants to help, but it seems to make nobody happy. It's, if you talk to some Native American groups, they believe it gives too much leeway to science, and that basically they have to do so much to prove kinship that sometimes can seem insurmountable. And some anthropologists and archaeologists feel that, specimens, and that's the way that they talk about specimens, not people, but specimens are being lost to science, and we're not learning as much. So everybody seems to be a bit grumpy about it, but it's part of an ongoing conversation that's, still continuing now, that we're dealing with these, 19th century problems at the beginning of the 21st century about consent, about, what skeletons are in our museums, how they got there, what to do with them.
Tyler tweeted, "I separated my shoulder in a bike crash 20 years ago. The bones still do their jobs, but without the specific architecture of muscles, tendons, and veins, there are clicks and pressures and muscles that have had to compensate. It's a reminder of how amazing and specific our skeletons are." I think Brian would definitely agree with you, Tyler, that our skeletons are indeed amazing and quite specific. And we'll get more into those specifics in a moment when we continue with Brian Sweetek. He is the author of the book Skeleton Keys. Maybe you heard a few years ago they found the remains of Richard III, the former king of England. They found them under a parking lot. They'd been paved over. We'll get into that story, talk about what that tells us about the history of our bones, and we'll get to more of your questions and stories in just a moment. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Cleveland Clinic. It's been 2,100,000,000 heartbeats since Cleveland Clinic performed the world's first modern coronary bypass surgery, which is just one of the reasons Cleveland Clinic has been ranked number one in heart care in the nation for 24 years, according to U.S. News & World Report. But it doesn't stop there. New cardiovascular innovations are always being developed and tested at Cleveland Clinic. For more information or to get a second opinion, visit clevelandclinic.org/heartcare.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, and on the latest episode of How I Built This, how Squarespace founder Anthony Casalena came up with the idea for a better website publishing tool in his college dorm room, and since then built it into a company valued at $1.7 billion.
Back now to our conversation with Brian Sweetek, author of the new book, Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bone. We got quite a few messages from you about your experiences dealing with human bones, including on a medical level. Here's what one listener left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Shondell, and in medical school, I worked in a cadaver lab. And so not only did we have to go through cutting through tissue, but I think my favorite part was sawing through bone. I don't know, something about the crunch about it.
Thank you, Shondell, for sharing your story. Speaking of the anatomy, let me get back to that tweet that I just read from Tyler. Tyler wrote, "I separated my shoulder in a bike crash 20 years ago. The bones still do their jobs, but without the specific architecture of muscles, tendons, and veins, there are clicks and pressures and muscles that have had to compensate. It's a reminder of how amazing and specific our skeletons are." Brian, this is a real basic question, but could you just give us a clearer sense of what our bones do for our body? Yes, they hold up the framework of the rest of it, but they do it in a very intricate way, and they do more than that.
Yeah, I mean, there are aspects of bone that affect just about every part of our lives. Like, so the story preceding our conversation had to do with bone marrow, the fact that our bones contain marrow that create our blood cells, the fact that bone is incredibly responsive and can heal itself. And, much of the same way that our bones initially grow from, the time that, we're in the womb through, adulthood and, old age, it's this system where bone is always being laid down. It's always being eaten up. It's always changing, that it's responding to our environment. It, you know, protects us. It protects our internal organs. Our ribs, you know, wrap around, you know, our heart and our lungs and so many other vital pieces. So it's really, you know, this multifunctional tissue that's much more dynamic than I think a lot of people understand.
With regards to our anatomy, Colin tweeted, "What's going on with our tail bones?" Brian, what about the tailbone?
Yeah. Well, those are, you know, this vestige of, you know, our evolutionary past. Yeah, they're just kind of along for the ride at this point. You know, they provide, you know, perhaps some anchor points for some, you know, muscles and soft tissues, you know, along with the other bones of our hips and our lower backs. But it's really just this wonderful little clue that, you know, millions and millions of years ago, our ancestors had tails. So I like this just little tidbit of our deep past that's still there.
Amanda tweeted, "Why do we treat bones more cavalierly than dead bodies?"
I think because part of that's the culture in which we view bones, that they become collector's items. Because, I mean, if you look at a human skull and really take a minute to look at it, there is a lot of personality there. Even if you don't see the, you know, the eyes or the, you know, soft tissues or anything that would, you know, make it, you know, a full face, that there's still so much personality there. I think that, you know, we've kind of gotten used to not questioning the fact that, you know, these are people, they're the remains of people, that there's been a mentality of the dead have no rights for, you know, hundreds of years. I'm really just starting to change that now. I had a conversation with a friend of mine who wanted to obtain a human skeleton as an artistic reference. And we had a conversation very similar to what you and I have been talking about. And at the end of it, she said, you know, it's kind of funny that I give more thought to, you know, the treatment of the chickens who laid the eggs that I get from the grocery store than the fact that, you know, I want to buy what, you know, is a person. So I think a lot of this is just, we haven't been investigating our own views and questioning ourselves about, you know, do we have a right to collect or own human remains? And I think, you know, that's something that's really just bubbling up and is going to continue for some time.
Well, and also I think we should just be clear is that a bone doesn't look like the person it belonged to. You know, I mean, if you saw me, you know, dead in a coffin, you would recognize it as me. If you saw my skeleton laid out on a table in a cadaver lab, you'd have no way to tell who it is. It's almost like it allows a certain disconnection from the humanity of whoever it was.
There is some distance. There is some disconnection. Although, on the other hand, some of this depends on expertise. I was at an event in Washington, D.C., where an anthropologist friend of mine, who I'd never met before, who knew me from Twitter, came up and said, "Oh, yeah, I recognize you by the shape of your skull." So I think sometimes it's the amount of detail that we're willing to go into.
Do you have some Cro-Magnon head or what?
I haven't had the 23andMe test done yet to see how much Neanderthal I've got in me. I've probably got some being of, you know, Western European descent. But that's the wonderful thing.
Well, everyone
about
of Western
bones.
European descent has some. I'm just wondering if, like, right, if you look like a caveman.
I haven't been called Beetlebrowed yet, but I'll get circled back if I do.
Matt tweeted, "Dr. H.H. Holmes sold the bones of his victims to medical schools." What's that about? Do you know that story?
I think that is, if I'm recalling correctly, that this was basically a murderous fellow who operated in Chicago during the time of the World's Fair. And he, you know, killed a number of people and then sold the remains. And that's gets back into the bone trade, that, you know, a fair number of skeletons or human remains that you might find for sale through various outlets came from medical schools that either closed or deaccessioned some of their collections or some of what they used to teach with. And that's a question that's worth asking, that if you are, you know, interested or looking into, you know, buying human remains, number one, I don't think it's particularly ethical to do, but if you are doing that, like, ask those questions, like, who was this person? Where did this come from? What's the history? So often, you know, these pieces are not only denuded of their flesh, they're denuded of their history, where we have no idea where they came from.
With regards to that, Jim sent us an email, a little graphic, kind of specific, nothing gruesome, but just fair warning. Jim emailed, a human skeleton from a doctor's office was offered at an auction recently. It came complete with a documented backstory that the bones belonged to a murdered Parisian prostitute. And indeed, it was possible to see the knife marks on her sternum. The bones sold for $200. It was legal, but it did not seem right. Pat tweeted, regarding indigenous bones, what about Geronimo's skull at the Yale Skull and Bone Society? Brian, descendants of Geronimo sued the society about a decade ago, I believe, saying that they basically robbed his grave in the early 20th century.
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with that particular case, but there are a number of famous skeletons, in various either museums or medical school colleges. That, you know, there's still a question of, like, should these bones be repatriated or returned? Who was this person? Can we identify them? And what were their wishes? So another example that's been in, you know, the news relatively recently is the skeleton of someone who was, you know, famous for some time, called the Irish Giant, Charles Byrne, who, you know, he had a physiological condition that gave him, you know, a larger stature. And famously, he kind of could hear the scalpels being sharpened, you know, as he felt, you know, his life was ending. And he made specific wishes to be buried at sea in a coffin so his body wouldn't be stolen, put on display. And that is exactly what happened, that the Royal College of Surgeons, or what became the Royal College of Surgeons in England, obtained his remains. And until recently, he was on display. There's been some murmurings that he may eventually get his final wish and a final burial. But especially with skeletons and remains that are centuries old or considered historic or have certain medical value, there's often pushback from the scientific or medical community saying, well, we can learn from these things. Or now there's a historical gloss to the outside of this that makes the bone something more than just that one person's life. And there's this constant back and forth that we really have yet to resolve.
Speaking of that history, we should definitely mention Richard III, the former King of England. He was reburied in an official religious ceremony in 2015, more than 500 years after he died. Here is a bit of that eulogy from the ceremony. It was written by a Scottish poet named Carol Ann Duffy and read by Benedict Cumberbatch, who has played the famous king and is his distant descendant.
My bones, scripted in light upon cold soil, a human braille. My skull, scarred by a crown, emptied of history. Describe my soul as incense, votive, vanishing. Your own the same. Grant me the carving of my name.
That was Benedict Cumberbatch reading a eulogy for King Richard III at a burial ceremony more than 500 years after his death. Tell us the story about how his skeleton was discovered, and also how they verified that it really was Richard III.
Yeah, so one of the reasons I picked Richard III as an example of sort of what we can learn from bones about somebody's life is because, you know, when you suspect somebody is king, you're going to give them the royal treatment in terms of anthropology and what you're going to pull out of that skeleton. So Richard III was supposed to be lost. No one knew where his body or his remains were. And there is a group of basically Richard III enthusiasts, called themselves the Ricardians, who wanted to locate his remains. So they worked with an archaeological group. And the archaeological group didn't expect to find Richard III or much of anything at all. As they said in some of their official reports, this is not what archaeologists do. It's not Indiana Jones where you're after the lost ark, or you're after a specific person. You know, you do your digs, you take your data, and you see what you can learn about different times and places and people. So they identified a place called Greyfriars. And, you know, today there's, you know, a parking lot over much of this excavation site, or there was. And as they started digging in, they started, you know, finding parts of the building and figured, okay, this is cool. We can learn about, the town at the time. And they came across this skeleton, you know, complete, that seemed to be osteologically male, and it had this bend in the back, the signs of scoliosis, and it seemed pretty
scoliosis, apparent, a curvature of the spine, right?
That's right, yes. And it seemed almost right. This was a good candidate based upon the time and the location, how everything lined up. This could be Richard III, particularly with that curvature of the spine. So Richard III has often been portrayed, you know, even by Benedict Cumberbatch, as, you know, hunchbacked and sort of stooped over and having some sort of malformation of the spine or of the back. So the fact that the skeleton had a pathology or something unusual about it and seemed to check all these boxes made it a good candidate. But what really verified it was the genetic evidence that was able to be pulled from those bones, because our bones preserve some of our DNA. It starts to degrade at death, but it does retain some of that as a kind of time capsule. So between, you know, the details in terms of the chronology, in terms of the anatomical details of this person, and eventually the genetic evidence, they're able to confirm that they really had found this long-lost king.
With regards to that anatomical evidence, let's get to another message. Here's what Reva in Chicago left in our inbox.
I teach drawing for medical students. I've been teaching from bones for 30 years. What I wanted to say is, because of the unusual nature of my own bones due to spina bifida, I've seen how small variations in the shape of one's bones magnify and illuminate the nature of what it means to be embodied. Bones for me are intensely beautiful and poetic, and I value every single bone I've ever held in my hands.
Yeah. Reva, thanks very much for sharing that with us. Brian, I know our time is short, but how much variability is there among human skeletons? Any particular kind of variation that most stands out to you?
You know, the variations that most stand out to me are the cultural variations. So what we can do to our own bones and still have them function. So, for example, head binding. So, you know, various cultures, you know, throughout the centuries, you know, particularly doing this with children, you know, when our skulls are relatively malleable, but either wrapping them up in boards or cord or something else to constrain the shape of the skull. So as our, you know, young skulls grow, they change shape and they can have this elongated shape, and it doesn't affect intelligence or anything like that. It's just like a fashion statement, or it's like I belong to this certain social group. Like for me, you know, I'm covered in a fair number of tattoos. If I lived, you know, hundreds of years ago in the steppe of, you know, Asia, I might have had an elongated head because that was the fashion at the time. Corseting can do something similar. It doesn't affect overall health, but it will change the shape of the skeleton. It'll change the neural spines, these spines that stick out from your vertebrae, and the shape of your ribs. And even though it doesn't cause any, you know, illnesses or anything like that, as once was thought, it's still a pretty dramatic change. And I think that's pretty wonderful that, you know, our culture can be recorded in our bones for perpetuity.
Bob in Cincinnati emailed, I believe that today's Ash Wednesday commemoration, beginning Christian Lent, would be similar to Dia de los Muertos. When we receive the ashes on our foreheads, we are told, remember, you are dust, and to dust you shall return. That was one of the things Adam and Eve were told when they were banished from the Garden of Eden. True enough, Bob, Genesis chapter 3. Before we go, one last tweet. D tweeted, what would your guests tell a little girl who wants to be a paleontologist? Brian?
Start reading. You know, the more that you can read about, you know, bones and anatomy and prehistoric life, the better. Eventually, when you can, try and volunteer at a museum. There are museums with volunteer programs all around the country that also run fossil digs. And just getting that experience and familiarity with bones. We live in an awesome time where there's more access to scientific journals and to books and to these opportunities than ever. So really, you can start educating yourself about bones from any point. That's how I have the career that I did. I don't have a degree, but I started learning about this because of this great availability that there is online.
Brian Switek, the author of Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bone. His blog about fossils for Scientific American is called Laylaps, L-A-E-L-A-P-S. Brian, thanks for talking to us.
That's been wonderful. Thank you.
This show was produced by Avery Kleinman and edited by Miranda Fulmore. You can learn more about them and the rest of our team online at the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.